Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here and to see so many people here. You've already gotten the summary of the book, so I don't know if I have to say anything more. This book began with an article, which many of you may have seen, that I wrote in Vanity Fair. Vanity Fair is not the usual place where academics publish. But what I discovered is that it got a lot more readership than the first article I wrote in Econometrica in 1969. So the title of that article was Of the 1%, For the 1%, and By the 1%. And I think the title really summarized much of what I'm going to be saying today, and the book is an elaboration on that. I want to make clear that when I'm talking about inequality, we're not talking about the politics of envy. One of the presidential candidates said you shouldn't be talking about inequality except in private rooms and hushed tones. My view is that inequality is one of the country's most important problems, and you should be talking to about it in large forums like this and very loudly. One of the main theses of the book is that this inequality is not inevitable and that we are paying, as the title says, we are paying a very high price for this inequality, both for our economy and more broadly for our society. A lot of, I think most Americans don't realize the extent to which inequality has grown in the United States. Watching inequality grow is like watching grass grow. It happens very slowly. It doesn't happen you can't see it year by year, although in recent years you can see it almost year by year. But over a number of years, it accumulates, and the consequences can't be ignored. So just to give you a few numbers, the share of the national income that goes to the top 1% has doubled since 1980. It's now around 20%. One out of $5 goes to the top 1%. The share that goes to the top 0.1% has tripled since 1980. Inequality in the United States has many dimensions. It affects every aspect of an individual's life, insecurity, life expectancy. The people at the bottom have a shorter life expectancy than people at the top. A dimension that's even more dramatic than income inequality is wealth inequality. The top 1% has about 40% of all the wealth. And things have been getting much worse in a very dramatic way. Just on Monday, the Federal Reserve released new data about what's been happening to wealth inequality in the United States. And what their results show that between the period 2008 and 2010, there is a drop in the median wealth. Let me say, median is the person in the middle, half above, half below, right in the center. So it reflects what's happening to the middle class, okay, to people in the middle. There was a drop in median wealth in the United States of 40%. Bringing the wealth of the median, the middle, back to what it was in the very early 90s, meaning that there's been no progress in wealth accumulation in the middle for over two decades. If the middle had kept up with the whole country, the increase in the wealth would have been 75%. Rather than the stagnation. You say, where did all the wealth that accumulated go? And the answer is, it all went to the top. Now, some on the right say, oh, you know, we aren't interested in the issue of outcomes. What we're really interested in, what really characterizes America, is equality of opportunity. Paul Ryan gave a speech like that, saying it's equality of opportunity. Well, what he didn't mention was not only is the United States the country among the advanced industrial countries with the greatest inequality, and this is something, we are excelling. We have the highest level of inequality of any of the advanced industrial countries, but we also have the least opportunity. And that's so contrary to our image. We think of ossified Europe, We think of other countries as having rigidities. There's no mobility from the bottom to the middle, or the top, bottom to the top. Well, we all know in the United States, we certainly read in the newspaper, stories of people who made it from the bottom to the top. Immigrants who come here with nothing and make it to the top. But the reason the newspapers highlight these stories is because they're so rare. What matters from a social science point of view is, what is the likelihood? What are the chances? And the chances of a poor American making it upwards to the middle of the top are lower than in any of the other advanced countries for which there are data. To put it another way, the life prospects of a young person in the United States is more dependent on the income and education of his parents than in any of the other advanced countries. And that's really something very hard for us to accept, because it's so contrary to our self-image, to our identity as a country of opportunity. But there is, in a way, a certain amount of hope and a really important point in this data that I mentioned, the fact that we are the most unequal and the country with the least equality of opportunity. Some people say that this inequality is the result of market forces, and we can't do anything about it, just the way the market works. But the same market forces are at work in all the other advanced countries. So the point of this is, the inequality that we have comes from the way we shape market forces. And that's really going to be one of the themes that I'm going to try to bring out and try to illustrate how we shape market forces in ways that make us distinctive, in having more inequality. Now, one of the arguments on the right is, don't worry so much about inequality, you know, about the amount of wealth that goes to the top, because everybody benefits. This is an old idea called trickle-down economics. You know, in a way, I wish it were true, because we've thrown so much money at the top that if trickle-down economics were true, we would all be very well off. But the data show otherwise. So that today, while the top has been doing very well, median income, the income of the middle, is lower than it was a decade and a half ago. So again, showing that most Americans today are worse off than they were, as I say, more than a decade ago. In fact, if you look at subgroups in our population, things are even worse. If you were male and you have to work for a living, things are really bad. The median income for a full-time male worker is lower than it was in 1968, almost more than 40 years ago. So the point is, if you have a sense that there are a lot of Americans who are unhappy, they should be unhappy. In fact, it's more of a puzzle why they aren't unhappier. And I think they're just committed to optimism, and I think there's great virtue. But eventually, the reality of what's happening will sink in. There's another argument that that is often put on the right, which is the people at the top deserve their higher income. After all, they've made a greater contribution. There's an old theory some of you may have studied when you were in college called the marginal productivity theory. It was a theory that was developed in the 19th century to try to explain inequality, and the idea was that people's wages, incomes, are related to their contribution. Well, that theory, the marginal productivity theory, was really, I think, totally undermined by what happened in the Great Recession. Because what we saw there in the Great Recession, the bankers got these enormous bonuses even as they brought their companies and the global economy to the brink of ruin. Their social contribution was negative. Their contribution to their firm was negative. And yet, they walked off with huge bonuses. Now, some of the banks were so embarrassed by this that they felt they couldn't call it a performance bonus because there was no performance. And they decided to change the name to a retention bonus. But there's a question is, why would you want to retain somebody who had destroyed your firm and destroyed the global economy? And what that says is, really, as I say, suggests that something is wrong with marginal productivity theory. And I'm going to try to explain what that is. The recession has been really bad for inequality. I mentioned the numbers before about how median wealth has gone down. In the recovery, though, we also didn't have a shared recovery. Now, the data makes it clear. The bankers recovered very quickly, but employment did not recover. And it's still the case that close to 1 out of 6 Americans who would like a full-time job can't get one. The official statistics don't reflect the weaknesses in the labor market. They don't reflect the fact that you're not unemployed if you're not searching for a job. And if you're not searching for a job because there are no jobs, it's understandable. If you've searched for a year or 2 years and you haven't been able to find a job, it's understandable why you might give up searching. But from the point of view of our statistics, if you don't search, you're not unemployed. But of course, you're not employed. But they just don't count you. So the fact is our labor market really is still very weak. And I'm going to come to one of the consequences of that, about the vicious circle that we're in, that as the economy is weak, inequality is getting worse. But that, in fact, contributes to the weakening of the economy. For now, I just want to mention one other fact of what happened in 2010, the year of recovery from the Great Recession in 2009, 93% of the increase in income went to the top 1% of our country. So that's why some people could say, oh, the economy was recovered. If you're one of the 1%, you were recovered. If you're one of the other 99%, things weren't quite so good. Well, I want to talk a little bit about what are the sources of this inequality. How do we explain it? It isn't marginal productivity theory. That's clearly not the explanation. There are many aspects of inequality in the United States. One of the reasons why it's such an interesting subject, there's a lot of inequality at the top, the extremes I've been talking about. There's been a hollowing out of the middle. I mentioned how median income has gone down, but the number of people that are within a certain range of that median income has also gotten smaller. There's been a polarization of the income distribution, more people in the tails, and the result of that is that there are a larger number of people in poverty, and the poverty gap, the distance, how much below poverty, that has been increasing. And each of these has their own explanations, and in the limited amount of time, I can't go through them all. But what I want to do is focus most of my time talking about the extremes at the top, but recognize that there are some of what I'm going to talk about is also explain what's happening to the middle and the bottom. I mentioned before that markets don't exist in a vacuum. We shape markets by our laws and regulation. And the way we've shaped laws in the United States, we've shaped markets in the United States, has advantaged the top. And let me just try to give some illustrations that show the extent to which this has occurred. One important law in any economy, in any modern capitalist economy, is the bankruptcy law. We don't talk about that very much, but it is actually a very important law. It describes what happens when somebody borrows money and can't pay what they owe. Well, in something that wasn't very noticed in the about a decade ago, we changed the bankruptcy law in a way that gave first priority to derivatives. Derivatives, remember, are those risky products that brought AIG to the brink of ruin, forced the taxpayers to bail out AIG to the tune of $150 billion. More money going to AIG than had gone to helping the bottom of the income distribution over a large number of years. Well, when you do that, you're saying, making a statement that affects our economy. Not only does that mean that the bankers get more money, but you're encouraging risky activities. You're encouraging this kind of derivatives because they get paid before workers or before anybody else gets paid. They have the first claimant if a company goes bankrupt. But at the other extreme, again, in the bankruptcy law, if you're a student and you borrow money, you can't discharge your debt even in bankruptcy. So it just shows you the contrast between the way we treat the derivatives and the bankers and the way we treat our students. Even if the school, and this is particularly true for a lot of the for-profit schools, doesn't deliver the education that they promised, even if you don't get a job, you're saddled with that debt for the rest of your life. And this is becoming an increasingly important problem because student debts are rising. The average student debt is now over $25,000, and it's been rising very rapidly. Tuition in public schools has gone up, went up between 2008 and 2010, data just released this week again, by 15%. And in some states, California, Georgia, and Arizona, went up by more than 40%. So tuition is going up. Incomes of the parents are going down. The only way to finance it then is borrowing. Students can't get jobs, part-time jobs. But they know that if they don't get a job, and the prospects of getting a job when you graduate now are much lower, that they're going to be saddled with these debts for the rest of their lives. And so if you want to know why opportunity is weak and why opportunity is likely to get worse in the United States, this is one of the key reasons for that. There's a generic explanation, a word that economists use for describing a lot of the inequality in the United States, and it's called rent-seeking. The concept of rent-seeking derives from the word rent. Landlords get rent not because of efforts, but because of their ownership claims. And so we've used the term rent-seeking as in a very broad way to describe those who get money, their income, not by making the pie bigger, our national income bigger, but by trying to get a larger slice of the pie, to get more income, more of the existing income. Now, when we look around the world, we look at some of the oil-rich countries, we look at disdain and we say those countries are rent-seeking economies. That's why they perform very badly. Everybody sees that pile of oil and they're all trying to grab it. And as they all try to grab it, rather than creating wealth, they destroy wealth. Okay? But what Americans don't realize is that we have become, to a large extent, a rent-seeking economy. And examples of rent-seeking include, for instance, monopolies. You have a monopoly. It makes money by restricting output and raising prices. So it makes the pie smaller than it otherwise would be. That's how they make their money. Or to give you another example, take some of the banks. And I really don't mean to bash the banks too much. Actually, I do. But a lot of the profits of the banks came from, some of it came from anti-competitive practices that I can't describe briefly here, but a lot of it came from predatory lending and abusive credit card practices. What was that doing? That was not generating well-being for most Americans. It wasn't creating jobs. It wasn't lending. It wasn't doing what banks are supposed to do. What it was doing is moving money from the bottom and the middle to the top. And so that kind of rent-seeking is increasing inequality at the top and increasing poverty and hollowing out the middle. So that's an example. But again, our laws and regulations give it scope. A lot of people recognized the nature of the predatory lending before the crisis, and they tried to stop it. But the banks fought back successfully and stopped the attempts to stop them. There was even somebody on the Fed board, Ned Gramwich, who said, when he saw the subprime loan, said, you know, this is bad lending. This is bad for the people who are getting the loans, but it's also bad for economy. And people like Greenspan responded, don't you have faith in the market? And refused to do anything about it, even though Congress in 1994 gave the Federal Reserve the right to do something, not only the right, the obligation to do something about it, but they refused to do anything about it. Another major example of rent seeking has to do with corporations. One of the interesting things is if you look at the people who are in the top list of the wealthiest Americans, richest Americans, it doesn't include the people who've really made major contributions to our society, the inventor of the transistor, the laser, the computer, the people who decoded DNA, the founder of the foundations of modern medicine. None of these are in the wealthiest Americans. But a disproportionate number come from finance and CEOs. And what the CEOs have been able to do is to grab a larger and larger share of the corporate income. And what's interesting, again, very distinctive about America, is that the CEO pay, the ratio of the CEO pay to the pay of the average person in the corporation is much, much larger than in any other country. Of course, CEOs in other countries look on envy. They would like to imitate, but they have certain social mores that say that that's outrageous. Now, you might say, is it the case that American CEOs are that much more productive? Are they 100 times more productive? That could justify this kind of pay differential. And the answer is obviously no. What is going on here? Very simple. They are taking advantage of deficiencies in our corporate governance laws, the laws that say give the power to distribute the rules of the game for corporation. Recently, there was a discussion in Congress of a provision called say and pay. You know, if somebody works for you, you would think that you ought to have some say in what they get paid. I mean, it's almost obvious. Well, the people who are supposed to own our corporations are the shareholders. But the CEOs in America said, if you gave shareholders who own the company say in the pay of their executives, it would be the end of capitalism, as they know it. And in some ways, it would be, because it would circumscribe their ability to take so much of the corporate pie for themselves. Other countries, though, like Australia, have these say and pay, and their corporations are just as efficient, just as dynamic as our corporations. So the answer is clearly that these provisions that are designed to try to circumscribe the abuses can actually make our economy more efficient. Well, there are a whole other set of sources of aspects of rent seeking. One whole category is I call called government munificence, government giving away money, and government give away money in a whole variety of ways. When I was chairman of the and a member of the Council of Economic Advisors, one of the tasks that President Clinton gave me was to try to ferret out what are the sources of corporate welfare of these corporate gifts. It was before this concept had become widely accepted. And one of the wonderful things about Congress is that it tries to hide this. It doesn't want this to be transparent, and that's why it was an interesting and difficult task. And the amounts are literally in the hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, these are large amounts of hidden giveaways. A lot of them, as I say, are hidden in the tax code, like for the oil companies and the natural resource companies. Some of them, the kinds of hidden subsidies, Bloomberg brought out some of the hidden subsidies of the Fed that the Fed was, gave the banks in the period of 2008, 2009, and 2010. Another set of gifts that are hard to see but mount to lots of money are when government pays more for something than fair market price. And the most dramatic example of that probably is the drug benefit. And it was very important to have this drug benefit, I think, in Medicare. But they put one sentence in that bill that said that the government could not negotiate, the government, the largest buyer of drugs, could not negotiate with the drug companies. The result of that is, of course, we pay higher prices. Estimated $500 billion over 10 years as a gift to the drug companies. Another example is when we sell national assets, our assets, at below market prices. So when we lease land for oil, minerals, we lease it at often prices that are far below the competitive price. And that's, again, a giveaway to the oil or mining companies. Well, these kinds of rank-seeking are part of the reason that America has, I think, become the most unequal of any of the economies, advanced economies. But they have one very important implication, and that is getting rid of these would create both a more equal society and a more efficient economy. I'm going to come back to that point because that's one of the really most important points in the book. Well, all of these help create, right, these and some other things I don't have time to talk about, help make the United States have this very large before tax and transfer inequality. And this inequality has, as I said, been increasing markedly in the last 30 years. But what is, again, very distinctive about the United States is we do less to correct that. So the after-tax and transfer inequality is even greater than it is in other countries. And as inequality in the United States has gotten larger, we've done less and less to correct it. The reason, of course, is, or the manifestation of this, is our tax code has become less and less progressive. In fact, if you look at it, in many ways, it's called regressive. Progressive means that those at the top should pay a higher percentage of their income. Regressive means that they pay a lower percentage. And that's symbolized by the fact that the top 1%, the average tax rate of the top 1% in the United States is 15%. That's 15% of the reported income. So we don't really know what their real tax rate is, but it's 15%. And that's much lower than those with much less income who work for a living. You know, Warren Buffett pointed this out when he said, you know, something is wrong when he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary. One of the reasons for this, of course, is the special treatment of certain categories of income, like capital gains. And this, too, has effects on our economy. So we tax speculation at less than half the rate that we tax people who work for a living. And when you tax speculation at a lower rate, what are you saying? You're encouraging resources to go into speculation. Now, as a teacher, I feel very sensitive to this issue because over the years, I've watched a larger and larger fraction of our best students go into banking, into speculation. It used to be that a lot of them would go into research, some would go into banking, some would go into medicine, some would go into public service. But the magnitude of the income and the favorable tax treatment has meant that a larger and larger fraction, in fact, now I would say a majority, of our best students go into into banking and speculation. And obviously, if we're misallocating our most important resource, our human resources, the talent of our young people, it's not good for our economy and for the future of our economy. Well, this brings me to the next subject, which is, what are the consequences of the inequality? And what I argue, and the central point of the book in some sense, is that we are paying a very high price for this inequality. A price for this inequality in terms of our economic performance, but also a price in terms of our sense of national identity, our democracy, the way our society functions. And let me try to illustrate those various principles. In terms of our economy, I've already illustrated some of the reasons that this inequality is bad for our economy. I talked about how much of the inequality is associated with rent-seeking, and rent-seeking distorts our economy. Resources aren't going to where they're socially more productive. They're going to where they can grab more money for themselves. And that means they're not going to ways that would enhance the size of our national pie. And that's why, by the way, in periods where we've had more equality, we've grown faster. In the decades after World War II, when we were investing in the GI Bill, when we were investing in the National Highway Program, our country grew much faster than in the decades after 1980. But this period after World War II was a period in which every group in our society, every quintile, every part saw their incomes increase, but those at the bottom saw their incomes increase the most. The period after 1980 has seen us grow apart, our society become increasingly divided, with those at the top growing a lot, and as we said, people at the middle and the bottom not doing very well at all. So that's one of the reasons. Another reason that an economy that's very divided doesn't do well goes back to the problem I mentioned before, the fact that we have become the society with the least equality of opportunity. And what does that mean? That means that if you have the misfortune of being born to parents who are less lower income and less educated, you are not likely to live up to your potential. You know, somebody said the other day, there may be another Watson and Crick among those people at the bottom, but they won't have the opportunity to get the education that would lead them. Even our, striking statistic, even our very selective schools, colleges like Amherst and Harvard, that have needs, blinds, and mission, the fact is that you can't get into these colleges unless you go to a good high school. And you can't go into a good high school unless you go to a good grade school. You can't go to good. And so the result of this is that only 8% of those in these highly selective colleges come from the bottom half of our population. So they've eliminated racial discrimination, but economic opportunity, they haven't been able to solve that. Some are working at it, but the numbers are very stark. There's a more general point that in societies that become divided, there is a reluctance to invest in the common good. Education of the young is one example, but infrastructure, technology, the basic research that led to the internet, the basic research that leads to the biotech revolution, there's a reluctance to make those investments in our common good. One of the reasons it's understandable is that if you're in that 1%, you don't need to rely on public parks. You don't need to rely on public education. You don't need to rely on public health because you can afford all these things for yourself. But there's another reason, which is if you're only 1%, you worry in a very short-sighted, narrow sense that government might use its power to tax you fairly. And that's the last thing you want, is fair taxation. In Oregon, you do have a senator that has been fighting very strongly for fair taxation, and I've very strongly supported his efforts in that way. There's another aspect, a reason that inequality is very bad for the economy. And it's manifested in the current recession, the current weaknesses, macroeconomic weaknesses. It's not an accident that in the years right before the Great Depression, inequality reached a peak too, just like it did in the years before this recession. And the argument is very simple. Those at the top save a much larger fraction of their income, on average somewhere about between 15 and 20%. Those at the bottom consume everything. In fact, in the years before the recession, the bottom 80% on average were consuming 110% of their income. And they were making a big contribution to demand. It was obviously not sustainable. Well, the point, though, is that when you redistribute income the way the United States has been doing from the bottom to the top, it weakens demand. And the Fed responded to that problem in a way that said, okay, if we create a bubble through lax regulations and loose monetary policy, we can generate more demand to offset the lack of demand that coming from our inequality. It worked for a while. It was a temporary palliative, but it was obviously unsustainable. Well, what is the problem today? Every once in a while, you hear notions that the American consumer is coming back. Not likely to happen. And it's not likely to happen even after we finish deleveraging. And the arithmetic is very simple. Roughly the top 20% gets 40% of the income. And if they save about 15%, the national savings rate from just that group will be about 6%. A savings rate in the United States before the crisis was zero. Now it's about 5%. So if anything, we can expect the savings rate to go up, even if the bottom 80% saves zero. So we are going to be facing a weak demand going forward, almost inevitably. And that comes from the high level of inequality in our society. Well, those are the economic consequences. And they're very severe. They're likely to get worse. There's a vicious circle in place that if you have weak economy, like we do, a weak labor market, there's downward pressure on wages. Wages have not been doing very well. Tax revenues go down, and that means government can't spend as much in schools and other public services, and that again causes more inequality. So we're in this vicious circle that is exacerbating the inequality, but the inequality is weakening the economy. So inequality, as I say, is, I think, very bad for our economy. The people on the right say, oh, we understand that there's a problem with inequality, but the cost of doing anything about it would be too great. That even the people in the middle would be worse off. Nothing could be further from the truth. The point of my book is to say we're paying a high price for not doing anything about inequality. Well, let me now turn to some of the other ways in which inequality some of the other ways in which inequality is hurting our economy. Do it fairly quickly. I argue that it really is misshaping our politics. Democratic politics is supposed to be one person, one vote. When you have one person, one vote, the outcome, well-established theories in political science, say outcomes should reflect those in the middle. They call it the median voter. Anybody looking at the outcomes of American so-called democratic processes has to conclude they don't reflect the interest of those in the middle. The average American is not interested, doesn't believe that, shouldn't believe that it's a good thing to tax speculators at less than half the rate of those who work for a living, or that the top 1% should pay only 15% in taxes and workers pay a higher percent of their income in taxes. I could go on with a lot, all the things I talked about. These don't reflect the views of what people in the middle. Our democracy is increasingly a democracy that is better described as $1, one vote than one person, one vote. And I think we all understand some of the mechanisms by which this occurs: campaign contributions, lobbying, revolving doors. There are actually a lot of other details: gerrymandering, the filibuster. Just like the rules of the game in economy shape the economy, the rules of the game in politics shape politics. And the 1% has been shaping the rules of the economy, and they've been shaping the rules of the politics. But there's a vicious circle here. The vicious circle is that when you have economic inequality, it leads to more political inequality, and the greater political inequality leads to more economic inequality. And that is the trap, the vicious circle in which America has sunk. This problem, manifestations of the inequality, though, get reflected in every aspect. Our sense of justice, our budget battles, I don't have time to talk about all of them, but let me just mention one, and that's justice. Because I think for Americans, justice is really, fairness is very important. In the Pledge of Allegiance every day, in school, children say, with justice for all. But actually, if you look at more detail of the way our system of justice works, I think it'd be better described as justice for those who can afford it. And nowhere was that more evident than in the foreclosure crisis, where the banks signed affidavits saying that individuals, to the court, saying that they'd examined the records and these individuals owed certain amounts of money that they weren't repaying. But they hadn't examined their records. And the result of that was that many Americans were thrown out of their homes who didn't owe a cent. The bank's defense was most of the people that they threw out of their homes did owe something. But a system of rule of law is supposed to protect the weak. It's not supposed to protect the strong like the banks. It's supposed to protect those of the middle and the bottom. But that's not what our rule of law did. And not one of the bankers who did this has been held accountable. As the Attorney General of the state of Massachusetts said, these banks have become not only too big to fail, too big to manage, but they believe that they're too big to be held accountable. And in some sense, they were right. And we all know stories, and we can go on. I don't want to get personal. The last chapter of my book, I talk about an agenda for reform. And the agenda for reform really derives very directly from the analysis of the sources of inequality. At the top, a lot of rank-seeking. We can do things to reduce the scope of rank-seeking. At the bottom, the weakening of unions, discrimination, a number of forces like that have played an important role. Lack of education opportunity that I talked about before. So once you analyze the sources of inequality, you really have a very easy agenda. I originally had 21 points. My publisher said you can't publish a book with 21 points. So it's there, but grouped in various categories of ways of addressing the problem. The difficulty is not the economics. We know what to do to reduce the inequality because other countries have done it. The problem is our politics, where our politics allow it. And I end the book on the question of, is there hope? Now, again, my publisher says it's not good to sell. You can't sell books that are too depressing. People do not want to buy books that are really downers. A few years ago, I wrote a book with Linda Billams on the $3 trillion war. And the only thing wrong with the book is that we underestimated the cost of the war. Data that's come out recently shows, and this is, I can't help but mention this, shows we had indicated that the number, just to give you one, that the number of troops coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan that were going to be disabled would be at least 40%. And some people said, oh, you know, you're making up numbers. The numbers that have come in is that it's closer to 50%. And many of them are coming back with multiple injuries. Our new numbers show that the cost of disability payments and health care for these returning veterans will exceed $1 trillion. And that's not in our budget yet. So, but anyway, the problem is that that book was very influential in Washington. It changed a lot of legislation. People did, some people paid attention to it. But it didn't sell as well as I would have liked. So let me try to end on a hope of note, on a note of hope, of why things might turn out better. You know, basically, you might say, how can things turn around? And there are two ways. One of them is that the top 1% could come to understand that it's not in their enlightened self-interest to continue in the direction we've been going. That you can think of the economy, a society, as a pyramid, and if the base of the pyramid is weak, the top is going to be resting on weak foundations. And it is in the that it is in their enlightened self-interest to make sure that we create a fairer society. And some of those in the 1%, let me make it very clear, really understand that. People like Warren Buffett do understand this. But unfortunately, a lot of them don't. The other way that things could turn around has to do with the 99%. They have to understand that they've been sold a bill of goods, that trickle-down economics doesn't work, that this notion that if we do anything about inequality, the cost to everybody is going to be very great. That's wrong. I've tried to outline how we could reduce inequality and enhance economic growth. There are a whole set of views that are simply wrong that they've been sold, that it's better to tax speculators at low rates, lower than those who work for a living. Again, doesn't make any sense, but a lot of Americans actually believe this. So one hope is that they finally wake up to what has been happening. When I look around the world, there are some causes for hope. There are countries like Brazil where there was a very high level of inequality. A lot of social instability, people living, you know, social, political, economic instability, and the 1% finally got it, that it was not in their self-interest. And the country came together, and first under President Cardoso, somebody who was center-right, he started investing in education for all. He was committed to transforming his economy. And then President Lula said, no child in this middle-income country should go to bed hungry. In the United States, 1 out of 7 Americans is on food stamps, and 1 out of 7 Americans faces food insecurity. And what's so striking is the effects are already evident. You can see Brazil is a country where it still has a high level of inequality, but the level of inequality is coming down, in spite of the fact that the same market forces are there that are facing all the other countries, including the United States. The other thing that gives me hope, if you look back in the United States history, there have been other periods in which inequality has been very high. There was the Gilded Age, the Roaring Twenties, and each of these cases, as we saw the economy, our society approaching this kind of brink, we pulled back. The Gilded Age was followed by the Progressive Era, where we passed antitrust legislation. The Roaring Twenties was followed by the era of the 30s, where we passed Social Security, Wagner Act, laws on hours and working conditions. We created a social fabric that all of us benefit. Social Security has essentially eliminated poverty among the aged. So we pulled back from those extremes. The question today is, will we do so once again? And my book is written in the hope that it will help us move in that direction. Thank you. Okay, am I supposed to call on you? Okay, are there microphones? No microphone? Okay, yeah.
Me?
Well, I guess so.
it's easier to understand and think about federal reforms that should happen. But have you seen states and counties and cities and municipalities do things that address the problem?
Yeah, there are some states that are actually working. Okay, the question was, I talked a lot about the federal government. Are there things that the states and localities are doing that are addressing these issues? And what I was about to say was that during this book tour, I had a really interesting discussion with the governor of Maryland in Washington, and he described what he was doing to keep tuition down, to keep access to education up, and that he was very concerned about, for instance, this education issue. A lot of the bankruptcy laws, a lot of the laws and regulations that we have are both at the federal level but also at the state level. And there's complicated issues of federal preemption that I can't go into. So again, on that dimension, there is a lot that can be done. The most important issue, I think, the responsibility for education is at the state and local level, and policies that they have of maintaining access to higher education, of maintaining a more equal education system, really is going to be the most important determinant of equality of opportunity going forward. Yeah.
A few years ago, Tom Friedman wrote very briefly in one of his columns that we need an ethical revolution in this culture. Can you describe what you've heard from others on how we might, what we can do in that way?
Well, the question was Tom Friedman said we needed an ethical revolution, and the question is, how do we bring that about? Well, the first part of the question is easy. I agree, and I actually talk about this. I think what some of the things that the bankers did can only be described as moral deprivation. When the bankers engaged in predatory lending and abusive credit card practices against the financially least sophisticated, that was morally wrong. It led to an instability, so it was economically foolish, but it was also morally wrong. You know, it's been 40 years since we passed civil rights legislation in the United States, but the bankers engaged in discrimination against Hispanics and African Americans because they thought they can take advantage of them. And when I say that, it's not just my judgment. They've paid mega fines for engaging this, some of the largest banks in the United States. And again, you know, in my mind, that's moral deprivation, you know, given where our society is today. Somebody asked about Jamie Dimon. I was at a conference with him not long ago, and he said, sometimes an aggressive way that he sometimes does, you tell me what's wrong with what we've done. What I said to myself is, where do I begin? But one of the places that I would have begun is exactly on this kind of predatory lending and abusive credit card practices, which he was not alone, but almost all the large banks engaged in this. Yeah. Yeah.
Did he not understand that, or was he going a different direction?
Okay. So the question was, back in the end of the late 90s, did President Clinton not understand what the WTO protesters in Seattle were talking about? Did he not understand the adverse effect of globalization on workers? And I think the answer is no. But let me try to elaborate just a second on that in two ways. What he would say is the response that we need is we want Americans to have high-skilled jobs. We have to educate them and enable them to compete. But unfortunately, we weren't making those investments. And while China was investing a lot in research and technology, we weren't. And while China was investing a lot in infrastructure, we weren't. And so the answer is, you know, in some ways, you know, he was right. What we want to do is upskill our workers, increase their productivity so that they can compete. But we didn't do it. There's another important aspect of this that I want to emphasize, though, and that is that in manufacturing, to a large extent, we are the victims of our own success. And by that, I mean the following. Even if we didn't have globalization, there have been huge increases in productivity outpacing increases in demand. And when you have increases in productivity outpacing demand, then employment is going to go down. And global employment in manufacturing is going down. Employment in manufacturing in China is going down. So this goes back to the more fundamental problem. We have to restructure our economy. And markets don't do that very well on their own. And that's another reason why we need a more active government. But when we have a weak economy, restructuring is even more difficult. And that's why all the austerity that some people are advocating would be an absolute disaster for our country. I should take another question. Yeah.
What do you say to the 99% that they need to do on a personal level to fight the inequality? What do we need to do on the city?
Okay. So the question was, what should a member of the 99% do to fight inequality? I think that you can, you know, focus it in two aspects. One of them is individually, if you have the resources and you can get educated, get the skills to make yourself more competitive. That's obviously part of what is important. But in the end, what I've been trying to emphasize is the inequality in the United States is a result of politics. You know, I thought of one time of calling my book in reference to President Clinton. You know, remember his slogan was, it's the economy, stupid? Really, the answer is, it's politics, stupid. And this is, I think, where the Occupy movement has gone wrong. They've not wanted to engage in the political process. And the only way that we're going to get change is through our politics. We still have, formally, a system of one person, one vote. And somehow, one has to convert the right to vote and make sure that the views of that majority get articulated and expressed in the electoral process. Yeah. Yeah, so let me say, there's a concern that we're training people for jobs that don't exist. And that's basically the question. And so the view is a lot of the jobs that are going to be created are going to be unskilled jobs. So why don't we just train people for unskilled jobs, i.e. don't train them. To me, the... Yeah, exactly. So the question is, and to my mind, this goes to the question of trying to restructure our economy, that the jobs we create are, we need to take a more proactive role in structuring our economy to create jobs that reflect the skills that we want to have. So let me just give you, other countries have succeeded in doing this. For instance, Germany just has retained a manufacturing sector. One of the ways they've done that is to have training for high-skilled manufacturing and creating a whole set of industrial structure that reflects this high skill. It's going to be very difficult for us to imitate Germany, but what I wanted by that example to emphasize that the industrial structure is a result of decisions that countries make. Let me just talk about one aspect of what has been going on in respect to job creation in the United States. One of the things that's been disturbing me a great deal is much of the innovation that's been going on has actually been replacing unskilled labor, even when we have high levels of unskilled unemployment. So many of you have seen, checkout in grocery stores and drug stores are automated. And it seems strange from a social point of view when we have all this unemployment of unskilled labor. Why are we investing so much, are investing so much in machines that will make even higher unemployment? Well, one of the reasons we're doing it is the Fed is keeping interest rates at a very low level. And that means the cost of capital is very low. And they're just doing what's in their self-interest. With low cost of capital, machines are less expensive than workers. And so it pays them to fire workers. And that's one of the reasons why when we get a recovery, we are likely to have a recovery that is more jobless. In fact, the data so far already show that to the extent that we've had a recovery, the recovery in jobs has been much weaker than has been in other recessions. But one way of thinking about the innovation going on is, again, innovation is affected by incentives. If we forced firms to pay for their full environmental cost, pay for global warming, emissions, we would induce more research to go into saving our environment and less research into and less research into creating unemployment. And so that's an example, even in this area, where public policy is really shaping the direction of innovation in our economy, exacerbating the problem of unemployment, exacerbating the problem that you talked about, and exacerbating our long-run environmental problem. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the Bush tax cuts are sitting on a big table right now, and if one candidate wins the election, that money will be freed up. If that person wins and if that money is released into the economy, what do you think needs to be done with that?
Okay, the question was about the Bush tax cuts and what will happen if that Bush tax cut especially for the top, gets repealed. The important point raised by that question is there's always an opportunity cost. The conservatives say this is not the time to raise taxes. But the point is that not raising taxes, especially on the top, has a cost. Raising taxes will generate revenue. And in a world in which you're worried about budget balance, you could take that revenue and spend it. And it is unambiguously clear that spending it in a variety of ways, and I'll describe them in a second, will stimulate the economy in the short run, create more jobs, and lead to more growth in the long run. And as that growth occurs, generate more tax revenues and actually improve our fiscal position. So anybody who's concerned about the long-run fiscal position should be should support the repeal of the Bush tax cuts. Now, there are lots of ways of spending the money. And this raises a more general point. Any firm, when you're looking at the balance sheet of when you look at a firm, you know, nobody ever talks about how much the firm owes. If you look at a firm, you look at what we call the balance sheet. What it owes, but that's one side of the balance sheet, but what's the other side? The assets. So if you borrow money and you spend the money on investment, you make the economy, you make the government stronger. The problem with the Bush tax cut is it doesn't show up in creating a real asset. So we took that money and we invested it in any of the things, infrastructure, technology, education. We have a public asset. We have an asset that will generate revenues. And the economy is going to be stronger. So my own view, right now, with the interest rates so low, short-term interest rates are zero, long-term interest rates at 1.5%, it even pays for us to borrow more to finance these investments. But at the very least, we should not renew the Bush tax cut, and we use that money for these investments. Yeah?
You talk about debt and debt forgiveness. Could you and would you write a book about the history and the current and future prospects for debt forgiveness?
Well, the question was about debt forgiveness. Let me talk about one aspect of debt forgiveness that's related both to inequality, the subject of my book, and to the economic recovery. And that is the fact that close to 25% of Americans who have mortgages are underwater. They owe more money than the value of the house. And part of the reason for this is that the bank sold them very bad mortgages, which left them to bear the brunt of the risk. And they, in many cases, engaged in a whole variety of misrepresentations. Well, I've argued in my book, Freefall, that what we need is what I call a homeowner's Chapter 11. Those of you who know bankruptcy law knows that corporations can easily discharge their debt. And when they do that, what happens is the shareholders get wiped out typically, and the bondholders become the new shareholders. Why do we do that? We do that because we believe that it's very important to maintain ongoing corporations, to maintain jobs, to maintain the productive capacity of our economy. Well, if it's important to maintain corporations, it's also important to maintain families and maintain stability of our families and our communities. You could use that same principle. What you would do is you would say that for these homes, we have to write down the principal, what they owe, and in return, the bank would get some share of the capital gain when the house is eventually sold. So it's not a free gift. It's an exchange. It's just like we do in bankruptcy. So that would allow the payments to go down, people to stay in their homes. It would reduce this flood of foreclosures, which is depressing housing prices and prolonging the economic downturn. Unfortunately, even before he took office, I emphasized to President Obama how important dealing with the housing problem was. But unfortunately, the bankers were not interested. Why? A very simple reason. It actually goes to a problem of accounting. If they wrote down those mortgages, wrote down the principal, they would have insufficient capital. And if they had insufficient capital, they'd have to raise new capital. And they didn't want to do that. That would dilute existing home equity owners, and they just didn't want to do that. And so the administration did not support principal reduction. They now have realized the mistake they made, but it's a little late. But they are trying. A few have been done. But even more recently, I pointed out, as other people have, that right now, the United States government is the owner of a vast majority of mortgages through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So the question is, since we own these mortgages, why don't we restructure them? But the bankers worried that it would be a bad precedent. The guy who is the regulator, the people at head of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, is a Bush holdover and refuses to do it and can't be fired because Congress won't appoint anybody that would do it to replace him. So when you're the president, you think you're very powerful, and now, I think President Obama would like to do something about it. He's being stymied. Really an interesting story.
Yeah. We have time for one more
question. Okay. Why don't you call on the person so I don't have to...
Raise your hands.
Back here.
Oh, my
God.
I like this. It's you.
I'll do the right here, right there.
Well, the question was, when I said there's a little of optimism, am I picking on the one example, Brazil, that was able to reduce their inequality and pinning my hope on that one example when the vast data suggests that extraordinary... Yeah, so let me say... the data say, as I say, that all the other advanced industrial countries have managed to manage globalization, same globalization, in ways that lead to less inequality and more equality of opportunity. And most of them have managed to prevent the magnitude of the increase in inequality. There's been some increase in inequality in most of them, but they've circumscribed it, and a few countries like France have actually stabilized it. So what I read from that is the note of optimism that there are tools, there are mechanisms by which we can circumscribe the degree of inequality and enhance the degree of equality of opportunity. Within democracies, you know, these are all these are democracies. So one can make the democratic process work. So that's a note of optimism. But I have to say that I'm not fully optimistic. When you read, you'll notice a tone in the book at the end. This is going to be a long struggle. It's not going to happen overnight. I think the reality is that things are likely to be getting worse before they get better. And things have been getting worse. And it's only through concerted political action that we're going to be able to stop the country from going in the direction in which it's been going.